Welcome to Daily Wisdom, Walking the Path with the Buddha, a podcast shared by David Roylance. This podcast is dedicated to guiding you to completely eliminate the discontent mind and the suffering it causes by attaining enlightenment. Learn and practice the teachings of Gautama Buddha that will guide you to fully attain a peaceful, calm, serene, and content mind with joy. To support this podcast, visit patreon.com/supportbuddha or visit buddhadailywisdom.com, where you will discover a full range of courses, retreats, and online learning resources to assist you on the path to enlightenment. Now, here's our teacher to share more.
Sawadee kap. Hello and welcome to Daily Wisdom, Walking the Path with the Buddha. Today is our Pali Canon and English study group, and we're studying Volume 11, which is titled The Realms of Existence. We're going to be studying chapters 121 through 130. In these chapters, the Buddha is sharing teachings about Nibbana or enlightenment. So welcome to all of you guys, whether you're joining for the first time or you've been joining regularly. The way that we do our Pali Canon and English study group is I have somebody read a chapter. I invite you to be able to read. Anybody in Zoom that would like to read, you're welcome to do that. And if there's nobody in Zoom that would like to read, then what I'll do is I'll read each individual chapter. I'll share some teachings on that chapter, and then I'll open up to any questions that you guys like. Typically, by the time somebody's studying in the Pali Canon and English study group, they've already studied some foundational teachings in some of the other programs that we offer, like the group learning program or the foundation in the path to enlightenment or some of the other courses that we have. But if you are coming here for the very first time, you'll surely learn something today. It's just that this isn't the traditional style of teaching where I'll usually teach for 15, 20, 30 minutes and then open up to questions. Then I'll teach some more, 15, 20, 30 minutes, open up for questions. This is more of a study group where students are individually studying the teachings of the Buddha in our book series titled The Words of the Buddha, The Path to Enlightenment, Revealing the Hidden. In volumes 2 through 13, that's what we discuss in this particular program, and it's a year and a half program of students gradually working their way through the words of the Buddha. The group learning program, which is going to be restarting from the very beginning tomorrow, that one is volume 1, where you're learning the foundational teachings. And each Sunday, I'm going chapter by chapter by chapter, and I'm going to be restarting that tomorrow at 9 a.m. Thai time and 9 p.m. Thai time on Sunday. So depending on where you are in the world, it may be a different time in your time zone. And what you'll do in that group learning program is on Sundays and Wednesdays, build up a real foundation in the path to enlightenment using this book, Developing a Life Practice, The Path That Leads to Enlightenment. And you can download this book for free. You can take it and go print it. You can get printed versions here in the temple that I teach at in Chiang Mai, or you can order them on Amazon. And the same like all these volumes 2 through 13 as well. They're available at no cost on our website. You can go print them. You can get them on Amazon or here at the temple as well. So again, I'd like to welcome all of you guys to our class today and invite you to learn with the original words of the Buddha, where you're able to understand his teachings through his own words. And this is what's going to really help inform your practice and be able to see exactly what the Buddha taught and what he didn't teach. So here, this first chapter, if there's anyone in Zoom that would like to read, you're welcome to volunteer to read. But then when we get to the question period, if you're on Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, and you would like to ask questions, you can put those into the comment section. I'll be able to see that. Or in Zoom, you can electronically raise your hand and ask any questions or follow-up questions directly. So this first chapter that we're studying today, which is 121, it's titled Nibbana, The Destruction of the Taints. Venerable Sir, it is said, the removal of craving, the removal of anger, the removal of ignorance, a knowing of true reality. Of what now, Venerable Sir, is this the designation? This, monk, is the designation for the element of Nibbana, enlightenment. The removal of craving, the removal of anger, the removal of ignorance, a knowing of true reality, the destruction of the taints is spoken of in that way. So here, this is just a very short discourse from the Buddha, at least he's just answering a question to a student, where the student's asking about these three poisons or these three unwholesome roots or these three fires, craving, anger, and ignorance, or the unknowing of true reality. This is kind of like a high-level description of what's going on in the unenlightened mind and why it keeps experiencing the discontent feelings, like anger, sadness, frustration, irritation, annoyance, guilt, shame, fear, stress, anxiety, boredom, loneliness, shyness, resentment, jealousy, any kind of displeasure or misery. This is all coming from craving, anger, and ignorance. And what you're doing on the path to enlightenment is you're learning about these and you're uprooting them. In more detail, it's called the 10 fetters. These are the 10 individual pollutions that the Buddha discovered, and you can learn what they are and you can uproot them out of the mind, applying the tools and the techniques that the Buddha taught. And this is where you'll see the condition of the mind gradually improving, that you'll see the peace and the joy coming into the mind more and more. So what craving is where the mind has this longing and yearning, this chasing after its own sensual desires, its pleasures. It becomes very selfish when there's craving in the mind. The mind almost becomes obsessed. It thinks that there's something external that's going to provide some kind of lasting satisfaction. So the mind chases it and chases it and chases it. And then if you get what you want, you get those pleasant feelings like happiness, excitement, elation, thrill, exhilaration, euphoria. But if you don't get what you want, then your mind moves to these painful feelings like anger, sadness, frustration, and others. So as those cravings aren't being fulfilled, this anger can arise. This is the bitterness, the hostility, the animosity. And as this is arising, oftentimes in the unenlightened state, an individual misunderstands what's truly causing that to arise. It's actually the craving, desire, attachment that's causing it to arise. That if the mind gets what it wants, it gets pleasant feelings. But if it doesn't get what it wants, these painful feelings arise. So with this misunderstanding that something external is causing your anger, you'll typically push people away out of your life, or you'll push the situation out of your life, or you'll become bitter and harsh and hostile or aggressive towards others, or you might put your expectations on people. The mind in the unenlightened state is uncomfortable with those painful feelings, and because it doesn't have the wisdom to understand what they're really coming from, then the mind falsely believes that something external is causing these feelings. So that's why the mind will push people or push a situation away, be bitter, harsh, and hostile to others, or put your expectations on people and try to control them and get them to do what you want them to do, trying to get those cravings fulfilled. But as long as the mind is doing this, there's less and less people that you can spend time with, and there's less and less opportunity for you to be happy and joyful, because as your expectations grow, as your wants grow, there's only a matter of time before you interact with somebody who does something you disagree with. So this craving is producing this anger. And where all this is coming from is the ignorance, or the unknowing of true reality, the lack of wisdom. Some people refer to this as confusion or misunderstanding or misperception or someone's wrong views of reality. The word ignorance nowadays is kind of more of a derogatory term, where a Buddha, someone who is actually enlightened, they're not going to talk in a way that's derogatory or demeaning. So this word ignorance is how we're translating what the Buddha taught, but he didn't speak in a derogatory way towards others. So a better way to think about this third poison or this third unwholesome root is the unknowing of true reality, or a lack of wisdom, this confusion that the unenlightened mind has, that the mind is confused. It thinks that something external is causing this anger to arise. So it stays stuck in this constant cycle of craving and wanting things to be pleasurable. And if it gets what it wants, it gets pleasant feelings. If it doesn't get what it wants, those painful feelings arise. And now it associates those to something external. And then that's where it pushes away, is bitter, harsh, and hostile, put the expectations on people. And then oftentimes when the mind is experiencing those painful feelings, it will start craving some more. So if you've ever had like a really bad day at work, and you like crave chocolate cake, or you crave to go shopping, or you crave drugs or alcohol, or if you got into a really bitter fight and you were hostile and bitter, and then you craved sex and wanted to have sex, this is the mind craving and trying to get back to those pleasant feelings, because it doesn't understand what it doesn't understand. It doesn't understand that there's these cravings that are producing this anger. And this is that ignorance. So we call it craving, anger, and ignorance, or the unknowing of true reality. But it's really because of this ignorance, because of this unknowing of true reality, that craving and anger continues in the mind. It's not until you learn, you investigate and examine the teachings of the Buddha, that you reflect on those teachings to independently verify them, and then you practice them, applying the techniques and uprooting the causes and conditions that are producing these discontent feelings, that you can uproot these out of the mind because you've acquired wisdom. So while these are called the three unwholesome roots, or the three poisons, or the three fires, craving, anger, and ignorance, there's actually antidotes or opposites of these that transform this. And that's what you're doing on the path to enlightenment, is you're bringing down your craving, anger, and ignorance, and you're bringing up the generosity, the loving kindness, and the wisdom. Those are the wholesome roots. Because whenever you're making decisions through the unwholesome roots, it's going to produce unwholesome results in your life. Like when you make selfish decisions that are based in craving, this longing and yearning, or when you make decisions based in anger, or you make decisions based in ignorance or unknowing of true reality, it's going to produce unwholesome results, or we would say unwholesome karma. But then when you transform your mind and gradually, slowly but surely, you're making more and more decisions based in generosity, which is giving and sharing more than is strictly required in any given situation without any expectation of anything in return. Then you're practicing this loving kindness, which is a genuine interest in seeing all beings be well, active goodwill. And then there's this wisdom, which is knowing true reality. When you base your decisions in these, then you're going to experience wholesome results, or wholesome karma. So this is what you're doing on the path to enlightenment, is working to transform this. So things like the Eightfold Path, the Five Precepts, the meditation training, all these other things are working to uproot these out of the mind. More specifically, it's the 10 fetters that you need to uproot. But the Buddha talks about his teachings in these layers, that when you first start on the path to enlightenment, you're learning things like the Four Noble Truths, which gives you a little window into the unenlightened mind and getting really into penetrating what's the real core, what's the real heart of what's causing these discontent feelings. That's the Four Noble Truths. And four simple statements, the Buddha is explaining that to you. But then you go a bit deeper and you start understanding the three unwholesome roots of craving, anger, and ignorance. But then as you understand that and you understand how to remedy those and the solutions, you go a bit deeper and understand the 10 fetters. And all of this is based around the Eightfold Path. That's the core central teaching of the Buddha that is going to guide you to eliminating all of these discontent feelings and getting to the peace and joy of the enlightened mind. So if you're interested in learning that, the group learning program, or some of the videos and books and audiobooks and podcasts and things that I've taught where I've described the Eightfold Path, there's various courses where I teach that readily. I'm teaching that in one of our programs at least once or twice a month somewhere throughout all the different live streams and classes and courses and retreats that I teach here. Sometimes I'm teaching it 3, 4, 5 times in one particular month because it's so important. It's such a crucial teaching to understand the Eightfold Path. And you're going to need to revisit that multiple times in your journey to enlightenment. So let me see if you guys have any questions on this short little discourse where the Buddha's talking about how eliminating craving, anger, and ignorance is what produces enlightenment. That's how you actually get to enlightenment. You can put your questions into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom in the comment section, or you can electronically raise your hand in Zoom and ask any questions that you like. All right, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So I'm going to move into chapter 122. This one is titled, The Destruction of Craving is Nibbana, Enlightenment. Venerable Sir, it is said, a being, in what way, Venerable Sir, is one called a being? One is stuck, Radha, tightly stuck in desire, longing, excitement, and craving for form. Therefore, one is called a being. One is stuck, tightly stuck in desire, longing, excitement, and craving for feelings. Therefore, one is called a being. One is stuck, tightly stuck in desire, longing, excitement, and craving for perceptions. Therefore, one is called a being. One is stuck, tightly stuck in desire, longing, excitement, and craving for volitional formations, choices, decisions. Therefore, one is called a being. One is stuck, tightly stuck in desire, longing, excitement, craving for consciousness. Therefore, one is called a being. Suppose, Radha, some little boys or girls are playing with sandcastles. So long as they are not free of desire, longing, excitement, thirst, passion, and craving for those sandcastles, they cherish them, play with them, treasure them, and treat them possessively. But when those little boys or girls lose their desire, longing, excitement, thirst, passion, and craving for those sandcastles, then they scatter them with their hands and feet, demolish them, scatter them, and put them out of play. So too, Radha, scatter form, demolish it, scatter it, put it out of play. Practice for the destruction of craving. Scatter feeling, scatter perception, scatter volitional formations, choices, decisions. Scatter consciousness, demolish it, scatter it, put it out of play. Practice for the destruction of craving. For the destruction of craving, Radha, is Nibbana, enlightenment. Okay, so let me help you understand what the Buddha is teaching here. He's teaching the five aggregates. These are also referred to as the five collections or the five elements. This is what helps you to understand what a living being is. Because anytime you cause harm, harm is going to come back to you, particularly when you're causing harm to a living being. So you need to know what a living being is so that you can practicing harmlessness, where you can now be harmless towards all living beings, including this being who you are. And you can also practice harmlessness towards the earth and the planet and the climate and things like this, because anytime you're putting harm out, harm is going to come back to you. But one of the main things that you're looking to not cause harm to is a living being. So you need to know what that living being is and how to define it. So the Buddha describes it as these five aggregates or five collections or five elements. A living being is going to have these five things. They're going to have physical form. They're going to have feelings, perceptions, volitional formations, and consciousness. So I'll explain what each one of these are. The physical form, and by the way, as you may know if you've been studying with me, is don't believe anything that I'm sharing with you. As I'm teaching this to you, you can reflect on this and you can try to discern whether or not this definition is truly holding up to what a living being is, because you know that you're a living being. So as I'm teaching this to you, you can reflect on this and see, do you have all five of these aggregates? And then you can start looking at other living beings too and see if they have these. So physical form, this is the first aggregate. The living being is going to have physical form, and you know that you have physical form. Then the second aggregate is feelings. This is pleasant feelings, painful feelings, neither painful nor pleasant. Then the third aggregate is perceptions. Perceptions are views and opinions about the world, the way you look out at the world. This might also be referred to as assumptions. Then there's volitional formations, which are choices and decisions. So a living being is going to have free will to be able to make decisions on their own. And then there's going to be a consciousness, which is the mind. So these are the five aggregates of what makes a living being, that it has physical form, it has feelings, perceptions, which are views and opinions about the world. It has choices and decisions, referred to as volitional formations, and then there's a consciousness or a mind. So you can see that you have all five aggregates, and you can compare this to a lizard, a dog, a cat, a monkey, a bird, a worm, you know, any living being that you know of. You can apply this and you can see that they have all five aggregates. But then to really doubly make sure that this definition is holding up, because the Buddha taught this 2,500 years ago, you would like to independently verify all of these teachings. You can take something that's not a living being, like maybe the chair you're sitting in, or maybe the electronic device that you're listening to this on. You can ask yourself, does it have physical form? Well, yes, that chair, that electronic device has physical form. Does it have feelings? Nope, doesn't have pleasant feelings, painful feelings, or neither painful nor pleasant. Does it have perceptions? Does it have views and opinions about the world? Nope, doesn't have those. Does it have free will choices and decisions? Nope, this chair can't pick itself up, walk down the street, and put itself back down. It's just not possible for it to do that. And then does it have a consciousness, which is the mind? No, doesn't have an actual mind. So here you can see that this definition of the five aggregates or five collections or five elements have held up over time. Buddha was fully awake 2,500 years ago to describe what a living being is. And now you understand what a living being is, and you understand the five aggregates. And one of the other reasons why the Buddha is teaching you the five aggregates is because you have these five aggregates, and the unenlightened mind is going to tend to cling to these five aggregates and hold on to them tightly. And when you're holding on to them, it's going to cause the mind to experience discontentedness. So for example, this physical form, if you are holding on to this, if you are clinging to the physical form, wanting it to be permanent, now when you see a pimple or a mole or a wrinkle, or you see gray hair, or you see a little extra fat or something like that, you're going to experience discontentedness. Your mind's going to be shaken up by that. Or if you cling to any particular feelings, wanting them to be permanent. Maybe you're clinging to pleasant things that have happened in the past, and now those feelings, the mind's trying to cling to those. And now in the present moment, you feel bored or lonely because you're not experiencing that pleasant thing. Or maybe you had something very painful in the past, and maybe the mind's clinging to that as well. Then there's these perceptions. These are the views and opinions about the world. If you've ever been in an argument where you were adamantly defending your position on something, or you were adamantly trying to convince somebody that you're right and they're wrong about a certain opinion or view, this is because you're clinging to your perceptions. And now there's unskillful conduct around that. The mind's clinging to these views and opinions of the world. Or some people refer to these as assumptions. There's situations where certain people, like police officers, are trained not to cling to their perceptions, because clinging to your perceptions, not only does it cause anger and bitterness and hostility, and you can be in arguments because of it, but it can cause grave consequences. For example, if you were a police officer and you were clinging to your perceptions, you wouldn't be able to do your job very well, because you need to investigate any particular situation. If you got a call over the radio to go to a convenience store because it's being robbed, and you're hastily making your way to the convenience store, and you get out of your car and you go inside, and you see that there's someone in a black hoodie with a gun over top of a person laying on the floor with a gunshot wound who's bleeding out, if you're clinging to your perceptions, you might think that this person in the black hoodie with the gun is the person who is the robber, and you might just walk in and start shooting that person. But you might have shot an innocent person. This could actually be the store clerk or the cashier who managed to get the gun out of the robber's hand, and maybe they shot the robber and the robber's on the ground. So police officers are taught to not cling to their perceptions, because if they walked in and just shot that person, they just shot an innocent person, they're going to jail for the rest of their life. So a police officer is taught to investigate and try to understand the situation. So when they walk in, they're going to probably pull their gun and say, "Put down the gun, put down the gun, police." And if it's the person who is the cashier who doesn't mean any harm, when they see the police, they'll willingly put the gun down because they know, okay, perfect, help is here, let me put the gun down. But if it's a robber, they're going to most likely turn towards the police officer and point the gun at the police officer. And this is where the police officer knows, okay, this person is meaning me harm, so now they might fire their weapon, right? But in a situation where you're clinging to your perceptions, either as a police officer or as a parent, or even working in an office environment, if there are certain things that are going on and you're clinging to your views and opinions, or you're making assumptions, you're not asking questions to fully understand a situation, you're going to be making decisions based on false truths. And now as you're making decisions, your decisions aren't going to be accurate. They're not going to be helpful because you're making decisions on false truths. So it's so important not to cling to your perceptions. You're always looking to get to the truth in any one given situation. Then there's certain choices and decisions, or volitional formations, that you have. If you cling to these, once again, you can experience discontentedness. Say that you made a plan to go on a trip to Thailand or Australia or Japan or something like this, and now 3 months or 6 months before, you get really excited because you're making this plan to go on this trip. And now you're so excited and you're clinging to this decision of going on travel. And when you show up to the airport, maybe your flight's delayed or maybe it's canceled. And now you might be angry or you might be frustrated because the mind is clinging to this decision. I want to go to Thailand. I want to go to Australia. I want to go to Japan. And the mind's craving this permanence, not understanding that every single plane can't leave the airport on time. Every single plane can't depart as scheduled. Some planes are going to be canceled. Maybe there's a strike of employees, or maybe there's a shortage of gasoline, or maybe there's a maintenance issue, because this is all impermanence. But if an individual is clinging to their decisions, then there's going to experience this discontentedness as a result. And you can notice all kinds of difficulties with this. Maybe you make a decision 6 months before about any number of things, but then as you get closer and closer to the situation, things have started to change. And if you cling to your original decision, then your mind's going to be discontent, and you're going to be making decisions based on old information rather than updating your decision based on the impermanent nature of how things are brought to your attention. So if you made a decision 6 months ago to do a particular thing, as things change, you need to update your decision rather than cling to that. And then there's the consciousness. The mind can cling to the consciousness itself, the identity that's in the mind, like your culture, your ethnicity, maybe your sexual orientation, maybe your nationality or your job or occupation. There can be a certain identity in the mind that the mind's clinging to, thinking that this is who you are. And now if you are hearing pleasurable things or agreeable things about your nationality, your culture, your ethnicity, your occupation, or whatever it is, you'll experience pleasant feelings based on the condition of hearing these pleasurable things and these agreeable things. But now it's only a matter of time, because of impermanence, before somebody says something degrading or disparaging about your ethnicity, your culture, your nationality, your job, your occupation, your sexual preference, any of these number of things. That someone maybe two tables over at a restaurant could be saying something degrading and disparaging. And when you hear that, if your mind is clinging to this identity, I am American, or I am Japanese, or I am Brazilian, or I am Mexican, or I am a Brit, or I am Aussie, or I am a police officer, I am a lawyer, I am a doctor, any of this I am that the mind is clinging to, when you have contact and you hear people talking in degrading ways, you'll be angry and frustrated because you're identifying with that, because the mind's clinging to the consciousness itself. So let me know if you guys have questions on this. This is the five aggregates, because what the Buddha is describing here next is he's describing an analogy of how children are playing with a sandcastle. And as they're playing with the sandcastle, they might be obsessed and holding on to this. They're having this desire, this longing, this excitement, this thirst or passion or craving. They're cherishing these sandcastles. They're becoming possessive with them. But then eventually they lose their interest and they scatter it and they demolish it. Essentially, they've let it go, right? And now if the waves come in and crash the sandcastle, no big deal. But while they're building the sandcastle and they're longing, yearning, wanting to build it a certain way, if the waves come in and destroy the sandcastle, they're so upset. But when they destroy the sandcastle and they've let it go, if the waves come in, no big deal, right? It's just a matter of, is the mind still holding on and still possessive of the sandcastle? So the Buddha is saying the same thing about the five aggregates. He's saying, scatter them, let them go, eliminate any kind of clinging to the physical form, to the feelings, to the perceptions, the volitional formations, which are choices and decisions, and the consciousness, to let this go, to destroy the craving. Practice for the destruction of craving, meaning holding on to this. Because when you destroy craving, that's what's going to produce enlightenment. Because with craving in the mind, you see some things as agreeable and some things as disagreeable. And you can only have pleasant feelings when you get what you find agreeable, then we'll experience the painful feelings when you experience the disagreeable. So if you eliminate craving from the mind, it's not as easy as just scattering the sandcastle. It's going to take some time to gradually build up your practice. But as you do, you can get to the peace and to the joy of the enlightened mind, because you've eliminated all craving, desire, attachment. So again, let me know what questions you guys have. You can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom. Or in Zoom, you can raise your hand electronically and ask any questions that you like. All right, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So what I'm going to do is move on to the next chapter, which is chapter 123. Here, this one's titled Directly Visible Nibbana, Enlightenment. Master Gotama, it is said, directly visible Nibbana, directly visible Nibbana, or enlightenment. In what way is Nibbana directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable, to be personally experienced by the wise? Brahman, one excited by craving, overcome by craving, with mind obsessed by it, intends for his own harm, for the harm of others, or for the harm of both, and he experiences mental discontentedness and sadness. But when craving is abandoned, he does not intend for his own harm, for the harm of others, or for the harm of both, and he does not experience mental discontentedness and sadness. In this way, too, that Nibbana, enlightenment, is directly visible. One full of anger, overcome by anger, with a mind obsessed by it, intends for his own harm, for the harm of others, and for the harm of both, and he experiences mental discontentedness and sadness. But when anger is abandoned, he does not intend for his own harm, for the harm of others, or for the harm of both, and he does not experience mental discontentedness and sadness. It is in this way, too, that Nibbana is directly visible. One who is unwise, overcome by ignorance, unknowing of true reality, with mind obsessed by it, intends for his own harm, for the harm of others, or for the harm of both, and he experiences mental discontentedness and sadness. But when ignorance, unknowing of true reality, is abandoned, he does not intend for his own harm, for the harm of others, or for the harm of both, and he does not experience mental discontentedness and sadness. It is in this way, too, that Nibbana is directly visible. When Brahman, one experiences the remainderless destruction of craving, the remainderless destruction of anger, and the remainderless destruction of ignorance, unknowing of true reality, it is in this way, too, that Nibbana is directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable, to be personally experienced by the wise. So here, the Buddha is just going into a little bit more detail about craving, anger, and ignorance. And it's the removal or the elimination or the destruction of craving, anger, and ignorance that produces enlightenment. That's how one experiences enlightenment. His student here is essentially saying, directly visible Nibbana, directly visible Nibbana. In what way is Nibbana directly visible? In other words, he's saying, how can you experience Nibbana? How do you get to Nibbana? What is the way to accomplish attaining Nibbana? So the Buddha is saying, oh, okay, well, it's through eliminating craving, anger, and ignorance. That's the way to get to enlightenment or Nibbana. And having done so, the being who attains this mental state does not experience any discontentedness and sadness. All those discontent feelings are completely eliminated. And you can see this for yourself. That's what the Buddha is saying here, that inviting one to come and see, right? That it's directly visible, inviting one to come and see, personally experienced by the wise. You can experience this Nibbana for yourself through eliminating craving, anger, and ignorance. You don't believe that this is the case. You don't believe in the teachings. You don't believe in anything that you're learning. You learn, you reflect, independently verify, and you practice. And as your mind cultivates this wisdom to be able to see the truth more and more, and you train your mind, you can experience this for yourself, that you can experience the complete destruction of discontentedness. So where some people might teach about belief, the Buddha never taught that. He never taught to believe a bunch of things and hope something good happens when you die. Instead, he taught people to come investigate his teachings. Come see for yourself, right? He says to investigate and examine his teachings. Because if you're a Buddha and you've gotten to enlightenment by yourselves, that's one of the criteria that makes a Buddha, is that you've gotten to enlightenment without the help of any teachers or any guides. You know with 100% certainty that the wisdom that you have as a Buddha will lead to other people's enlightenment as well. Because if it led to your enlightenment, it will lead to other people's enlightenment as well. It's just a matter of them investigating and examining the teachings close enough, and they will be able to transform their mind and be able to see and experience Nibbana for themselves. So a Buddha is sharing with people, come investigate my teachings. Come examine them. Because if you examine them close enough and you investigate them close enough, you'll be able to see the truth for yourself, and the mind will be experiencing more and more peace and more joy. So this is one of the things that the Buddha does, is he will regularly invite people or encourage them to examine and investigate his teachings. In terms of craving, anger, and ignorance, I explained that earlier in the first discourse. So if you guys have any questions on any of these other things that the Buddha is describing here in this discourse, you're welcome to ask questions on those. All right, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So I'm going to move to the next chapter. That's chapter 124. Here, this one is titled, Directly Visible Nibbana, Spoken by the Perfectly Enlightened One, Shared by the Venerable Ananda. So this is one of the Buddha's closest students recounting this, that they didn't write the teachings down until after the death of the Buddha. And Ananda is the person who's really credited with having remembered a lot of the teachings, word for word for word. By the time you get to enlightenment, you'll never forget the wisdom that it took for you to get to enlightenment. But in terms of the crispness of your memory, an enlightened being is going to have a very crisp, very clear memory. Ananda was with the Buddha essentially from the very beginning when he first started teaching all the way till his death, which is 45 years. So Ananda is credited with having remembered a significant amount of the teachings. So you'll see regularly that Ananda is referenced in the various teachings, because him and 499 other enlightened beings got together shortly after the Buddha's death and started documenting his teachings. So here Ananda is recounting this, that was a teaching from the Buddha. But first, here's a student asking a question. It is said, friend, directly visible Nibbana, enlightenment, directly visible Nibbana. In what way has the perfectly enlightened one spoken of directly visible Nibbana? Hear, friend, distant from sense desires, distant from unwholesome mental states, enters and resides in the first jhana, which is with thinking and pondering, based in seclusion, filled with excitement and joy. To this extent, too, the perfectly enlightened one has spoken of directly visible Nibbana, enlightenment, in a provisional or temporary sense. In reference to the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana, the base of the infinite space, the base of the infinite consciousness, the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception, identical aspects correlating to the first jhana were spoken. Also, the state of directly visible Nibbana is provisionally, temporarily revealed. The elimination of perception and feeling, as is the destruction of the taints, is non-provisionally, permanent, explained to be directly visible Nibbana, as in the following passages. Again, friend, by completely overcoming the base of neither perception nor non-perception, a monk enters and resides in the elimination of perception and feeling, and having seen with wisdom, his taints, fetters, are completely destroyed. To this extent, friend, the perfectly enlightened one has spoken of directly visible Nibbana, in a non-provisional or permanent sense. Okay, so let me help you understand what the Buddha is talking about here. This is another question from a student about essentially how to experience enlightenment. How is one experiencing, and what is their experience on the way to enlightenment? So the Buddha is talking first about these attainments. There's 8 individual attainments that you experience prior to getting to the first stage of enlightenment. Not everybody's going to experience all those attainments. The 4 jhanas, anybody who is making their way to enlightenment and ultimately gets to the first stage of enlightenment, you would have needed to work your way through the 4 jhanas in order to get to the first stage of enlightenment. But these other 4 attainments, you aren't always going to experience these. Some people experience some of them and some people don't. So what these are, these jhanas, are four preliminary phases that the mind experiences on the way to the first stage of enlightenment. There are certain heightened qualities that one experiences. It's almost like the light bulb is flickering. This is the way I describe it. And that's what the Buddha is talking about here. He's saying that when you experience these jhanas, it's like a provisional sense. It's temporary, meaning that you kind of get these little flickers of what enlightenment is like, meaning like 1 minute, 1 hour, 1 day, 1 week, 1 month, you start experiencing for that extended period of time the qualities of what an enlightened mind is going to experience. You'll start noticing this peace and joy coming into the mind. You'll notice this heightened awareness or mindfulness. You'll notice these various qualities, and the Buddha describes them in detail when he describes the four jhanas in detail. And I teach that in other classes and other courses and other programs that I share. So as your mind is starting to experience these jhanas, this is an indication to you that you're putting together the Eightfold Path really well. Because putting together the Eightfold Path is what's going to produce the jhanas. And this is where it gets really real for you, that if you're reading the teachings of the Buddha, where he spoke these 2,500 years ago, and then they were documented shortly after his death, and now you've been practicing those teachings, and you start experiencing the very qualities that he was describing, and you're tracking right along that, and you're like, oh my goodness, my mind's experiencing that, and it's experiencing that, and it's experiencing that. You'll know that what he spoke was the truth, because here you're looking at a book from teachings of 2,500 years ago that were spoken by a man, and here it is in front of you, and you've been learning and practicing his Eightfold Path, and you're starting to experience those same exact qualities that he's describing. So that's what he's talking about here, is that as you're making your way to enlightenment, there's these temporary periods of time where your mind can seem like it's enlightened, because you're experiencing these glimpses of the peace and the joy starting to shine through. The mind is brightening up. It's becoming more radiant and more joyful. But these are temporary, that it's only a matter of time before there's some discontentedness that comes in. Again, it can be 1 minute, it can be 1 hour, it can be 1 day, it can be 1 month, 1 week, but eventually, because the mind is not yet enlightened, there's going to be this discontentedness that comes in. But by the time you get to enlightenment, where you've completely destroyed the fetters, you've experienced the complete elimination of all the pollutions of mind, there enlightenment is permanent. That's what the Buddha is explaining to you. Because the causes and conditions, the pollution that's in the mind, that's what's causing the discontent feelings to arise, to change, and to fade away. But when you uproot all of that and you purify the mind, now there's no causes and conditions that are producing discontentedness. The mind is unconditioned. So you're experiencing unconditioned joy or unconditioned happiness. The mind is just always in that enlightened mental state. From the moment you wake up all day long and when you go to sleep, your mind is joyful, it's uplifted, it's bright, it's radiant. You're always in a good mood, you're never even in a bad mood. That's the permanent aspect of the enlightened mind, because the mind no longer has the causes and conditions that are producing these discontent feelings. So here the words that the Buddha is using is non-provisional, or another way to say that is permanent. The enlightened mind is actually permanent because it's been completely purified of those pollutions that are causing the mind to be shaken up. So let me know what questions you guys have here on this particular chapter. You can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom. Or in Zoom, you can raise your hand and ask any questions that you like. Okay, we have a question coming in from Mayu Lee on Facebook. She says, when the Buddha mentioned thinking and pondering in the first jhana, is the thinking and pondering based on his teachings on your daily practice? Yes. What you're experiencing in that first jhana, when there's thinking and pondering, and you also experience it in the second jhana or two, but then it starts to fade, is that prior to the path to enlightenment, when we don't have wisdom of anything but just kind of how to live life to a certain degree, how to sustain our life, we're just kind of going through the world, knocking down the trees, burning up the forest. We're just kind of haphazardly making decisions based on whatever we think would be helpful in any one given situation. And we can firmly believe that we're making good decisions, but because our mind is not awake to the wisdom of the natural laws of existence, we're making unwise decisions and we're experiencing these unwholesome results coming back to us. But as you get onto the path to enlightenment and you start learning the Eightfold Path and you're practicing it to a certain level, as your mind moves into these jhanas, you start doing what's called thinking and pondering, which is any decision that you're about to make, you know that it's going to produce either unwholesome results if it's unwise, or it's going to produce wholesome results if you're making wise decisions. So by the time somebody gets into those jhanas, they start thinking and pondering. They start paying careful attention to the decisions that they're making. And they start comparing and contrasting it to the teachings. Like maybe you're getting ready to have a conversation with your children or your husband or your wife, or you're getting ready to make a career decision or something like this. And you start thinking and you start pondering whether or not it would be wise to do any particular thing. You might in the past have just gone into a shoe store, bought a pair of shoes and headed out with your pair of shoes, where now you might think, you know, do I have the money for this? Is this a need? Is this a want? Why is it that I need these shoes? Is it truly a need or is it a want? You might start thinking and pondering. And as you do, and you start thinking about your interactions with your coworkers and your family and any career decisions, any life decisions, you start cultivating this wisdom through this thinking and pondering. And you start bringing on board more and more wisdom. So your mind can be in that thinking and pondering for an extended period of time. These jhanas, they're not one day, they're not one week, they're not one month. You'll be in those jhanas for a period of time, particularly that first jhana, thinking and pondering, and you're building more and more and more and more wisdom about how to make wise decisions. And eventually, as you move out of that first and second jhana, the thinking and pondering isn't there. The thinking and pondering can almost be obsessive when you're in that first and second jhana. When you're not in those jhanas, when you go into the third, fourth jhana, when you're in the first stage of enlightenment, you still pay careful attention to all your decisions, but you have a certain amount of wisdom on board that now is more fluid for you. It's more easy to make decisions. Where in that first jhana, this is really like deep thinking, introspection, being very reflective, maybe taking a really long time to make a more simple decision of something that you were trying to make a decision about in the past, where you would have just quickly and easily made the decision. Now you're really slowing it down and taking your time. And this is what's going to help you build your wisdom so that then later on, as you keep practicing, you'll be able to make decisions more fluidly because you've brought on this wisdom through the thinking and pondering. Okay, we have a question here from Charlotte. I'm not sure that that's Charlotte. I think that might be another student, maybe Brent or something logging in. Yeah, it's Brent. That's what I thought. Okay, so here's Brent's question. When the Buddha mentioned the fourth jhana, he stated it's beyond pleasure and pain. Is this physical, mental, or both? So the way that he describes the fourth jhana and the way that he even describes enlightenment is he talks about it beyond pleasure and pain. All the way to enlightenment, you're going to still be experiencing some discontent feelings. They're going to become more and more muted. They're going to become less and less as you make your way to enlightenment. By the time you're in like that third stage of enlightenment, for example, you can go like 3 months or 6 months without any discontentedness at all. You might actually think you're enlightened, but then a little bit of ickiness will come in. For like 30 seconds or a minute or two, you'll experience a little bit of ickiness and you'll know you're not enlightened and there's more work to be able to do. That's why it's important to never convince yourself that you're enlightened. But all the way up until enlightenment, you're gonna be experiencing mental discontentedness. Even when you're enlightened though, you're going to experience physical pain, but it's gonna be very different. When you're enlightened, you're not gonna be experiencing any mental pain. There's no mental anguish, but you'll still experience physical pain, but it'll be very muted. Where before, if you stumped your toe in the unenlightened state, you would feel the physical pain, but you also experience mental anguish. And this is where you might get frustrated or agitated or annoyed. You might start cussing, and it heightens the physical pain and it intensifies the physical pain. But by the time you get to enlightenment, if you stump your toe, you'll know that it's impermanent. And you won't get frustrated, you won't get agitated or annoyed. You'll just experience the physical pain and then it'll be gone within a few minutes. And it was very muted compared to the physical pain that you experienced in the past, because in the past, it was the physical pain and the mental anguish going together and really heightening this experience. Where in the enlightened mind, you're just experiencing the physical pain, which is quite muted. So this beyond pleasure and pain that the Buddha is talking about is that by the time you're in the fourth stage of enlightenment, you've given up this pleasure and pain. You understand that the goal in life is not to chase after pleasure in terms of temporary pleasure, that you're not chasing and chasing and chasing this excitement and this temporary exhilaration and euphoria. You understand that this life is not about chasing money or esteem or fame or fortune. It doesn't mean you don't work towards those things. You can still work towards a higher income. You might still work towards being more famous or something like this, but it's when you chase after it and you think that this thing is going to provide lasting satisfaction that you set yourself up and you kind of sabotage yourself. So being beyond pleasure and pain here in the fourth jhana is to give up the idea that something, some material object, something external is going to provide some kind of lasting satisfaction. But the mind itself is still going to experience pleasure and pain, even in the fourth jhana, because you're still experiencing discontentedness. It's not until you get to enlightenment that the mind is no longer experiencing discontentedness. But in the enlightened mind, you're still experiencing pleasure, but it's not conditional pleasure, where up until enlightenment, your mind can only experience the pleasure based on some condition, that if my bank account's this, I'll have pleasure. If it's sunny outside, I'll have pleasure. If my mom or dad do this, or my boss does this, I'll have pleasure, I'll be happy. But in the enlightened mind, you're gonna just have pleasure all the time. Your mind's going to always be pleasurable. You're gonna have unconditioned joy that is there. So here when he's talking about beyond pleasure and pain in the fourth jhana, it's just that you've given up pleasure and pain. You understand that that's no longer going to be satisfying and you kind of lose interest in chasing after those things. But when he talks about beyond pleasure and pain in the enlightened mind, here, what he's talking about is beyond conditional experiences, where you're no longer experiencing conditioned feelings. Your mind is just always joyful and always pleasurable, we could say. You're welcome, Brent. Pleased to help you. Okay. I'm not seeing any other questions here, so I'm going to move to chapter 125. Let me take a little bit of here. Oh, my glass is empty, so I'm going to need a refill. I'll just remind you guys while I'm pouring water that anybody in Zoom that would like to read, you guys are welcome to volunteer and read by just electronically raising your hand, and then you can unmute yourself. Okay, so here we've got chapter 125. This one is titled Nibbana in This Very Life, or Enlightenment. There are, householder, forms recognizable by the eye that are desirable, lovely, agreeable, pleasing, sensually enticing, tempting. If a monk does not seek excitement in them, does not welcome them, and does not remain holding to them, his consciousness does not become dependent on them or cling to them. A monk without clinging attains nibbana. There are, householder, sounds recognizable by the ear, odors recognizable by the nose, flavors recognizable by the tongue, physical objects recognizable by the body, mental objects recognizable by the mind, that are desirable, lovely, agreeable, pleasing, sensually enticing, tempting. If a monk does not seek excitement in them, does not welcome them, and does not remain holding to them, his consciousness does not become dependent on them or cling to them. A monk without clinging attains nibbana, enlightenment. This is the cause and reason, householder, why some beings here attain nibbana in this very life. Monk, if through fading away of strong feelings towards the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind, through its fading away and elimination, one is liberated by non-clinging, one can be called a monk who has attained nibbana, enlightenment, in this very life. Okay, so what the Buddha is describing here is he's talking about first, he's talking about the sixth sense base, that here he's describing the elimination of central desire, that the eye is going to long for physical forms. It's going to want to see things that are agreeable, that are pleasing, sensually enticing and tempting, that the mind is longing, yearning through the eye. This is the central desire that's in the mind. This is one of the pollutions or the taints. And if the mind sees and experiences contact with something that is agreeable through the eyes, it'll experience conditioned pleasant feelings. like it's sunny outside and you see the sun, you might get excited. Or you see like a mom or dad holding the hand of their child walking down the street, you might get so excited. Wow, this is so nice. Look at that young child walking with their parents. Oh, that's so beautiful. That's so lovely. Well, the problem with sensual desire is that you'll form your inner feelings based on some condition of something you see, something you hear, something you smell, something you taste, something that comes in contact with the body, or something in the mind. And as long as you're getting what you agree with, then the mind can experience those conditional pleasant feelings. But because everything around you is impermanent, you can't get permanently agreeable forms, sounds, odors, flavors, physical objects, or mental objects that you're coming in contact with. So now, when you see that parent holding the child and you get all these warm, fuzzy feelings that they're holding their child's hand, you might now turn the corner and you see a parent slap their child across their face. We're not talking about what's wise or unwise here, because it's very unwise to do that. But you can't control what other people do, and you live in an impermanent world where some parents are going to treat their children very warm and very loving, and other parents are going to be aggressive and hostile and bitter to their children. And now when you see that maybe with your eye, it's disagreeable to the mind, and now you get frustrated or irritated or agitated or annoyed because the mind is clinging and holding on to this agreeable contact through the eyes of seeing this mom or dad holding their child's hand walking down the street. And the same thing is happening with all these other sense bases, like the ears. If you're sitting at a traffic light and you hear music next to you, and you're like, oh wow, you know, that's my music, that's my jam, and you start dancing in your seat, you get so excited because of the music that you're hearing. Well, now you pull up to the next traffic light, and now somebody else pulls up next to you, and this is music that you despise, right? And now the ear is experiencing a sound that is now the mind is coming in contact with, and now the mind sees this as disagreeable, and now you get frustrated or irritated or agitated. It's because you were exciting in those contacts. Here, when the Buddha is talking about exciting in them, right? That if you do not excite in them, if you do not welcome them, if you do not remain holding on to them, then your consciousness does not become dependent on them, meaning you don't get attached to them, right? So if that music pulls up next to you and you're just so excited, yay, my music, now you're welcoming it, you're exciting in it, you're holding on to it, your mind is being dependent on it. You can only experience pleasant feelings when you hear that pleasurable music. So now, because you're clinging to this experience, when you get to the next traffic light and you hear this other music, now you're frustrated, you're irritated, you're agitated, you're annoyed. But the Buddha is saying, if you don't do this, when you have no clinging, then you attain nibbana, because your mind doesn't have this craving and clinging, that you don't see things as agreeable and disagreeable. It's just contact. It's just sound. The music of the first person that comes up, okay, great, that's some pretty cool music. They've got some good taste in music. Yeah, I like that music too. All right, that's pretty nice. And then you pull up to the next light and someone pulls up to you with some different music. Hey, that's not music I would listen to, but you know what? That person's having a good time and that's wonderful. You can maintain your joy, right? Because you're not clinging, you're not craving any one particular thing. Hey, if they like that music, that's outstanding. You know, this person sitting here with that music, it's only going to be 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes. The light's going to turn green and they're going to go, or I'm going to go and I'm not going to be hearing that music anymore. So there's no need to get frustrated or agitated or annoyed just because of this impermanent sound. But when you have craving and clinging in your mind, you won't be able to do that. So it's these six sense bases through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, the body, and the mind itself that one is experiencing this. And what the mind is doing with this six sense base is there might be something pleasurable or painful in the past that has occurred, and now in the present moment, you're thinking about that. And now you're experiencing pleasure or pain in the present moment based on something that happened in the past. You haven't had any contact through the eyes, ears, nose, the tongue, or the body. It's just the mind thinking about something in the past. Or the same thing can happen in the future. The mind in the present moment can be thinking about the future and be experiencing pleasant feelings or painful feelings based on its craving and clinging. So that's why the Buddha describes the mind as the sixth sense base, because there's this contact through these six sense bases. And what you would like to do is build this guard where you're guarding these six sense bases. The way you guard the six sense bases is with your mindfulness or your awareness of mind, that you protect the mind, that you don't allow the mind to long and yearn. So when you see that mom and dad walking down the street holding the hand with the child, it's like, oh, that's wonderful. But you don't cling to it. You don't excite in it. And now when you turn the corner and you see a parent slap their child, that's unfortunate, right? But you don't form your inner feelings based on that thing. That's what the unenlightened mind's going to want to do, is base its inner feelings on what the parents are doing, what the music's doing, what the weather is outside. And that's what the Buddha is explaining here, is that this central desire, the mind has this longing, yearning through these six sense bases. And in order to get to enlightenment, you're going to need to eliminate your clinging. And the way that you do that is you need to understand that the pleasant feelings are part of the problem. This is what the unenlightened mind has a challenge to understand, is that it's not just the painful feelings, the anger, sadness, frustration, irritation, annoyance, guilt, shame, fear, stress, anxiety. It's very clear for people that, yeah, they need to eliminate that. But you need to eliminate these pleasant feelings. It's the conditional pleasant feelings. You can't get to permanent joy and permanent happiness if you hold on to the temporary conditional excitement or the conditional happiness. So when your mind is basing its inner feelings of happiness on some condition, when that condition changes, you're going to experience the painful feelings. So you need to get way ahead of the curve and observe that the mind is trying to cling and hold on and welcome this excitement into the mind. Because as soon as you do that, it's only a matter of time before that condition changes and you're going to end up in the painful feelings. So if you'd like to get rid of the painful feelings, you've got to eliminate the conditional pleasant feelings, that your mind doesn't base its inner feelings on some condition. So then by letting go of the temporary happiness, you can get to the permanent joy, the permanent peace, the permanent happiness. That's what you ultimately would like to get to. So let me know what questions you guys have here. You can put it into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, or you can raise your hand in Zoom and ask any questions that you like. Okay, it looks like Mayuli has a following question here. She says, "Teacher, I have a follow-up question. The joy that the Buddha mentioned, is he talking about the joy that you get during your thinking and pondering?" The joy that he talks about in the jhanas, that's kind of like a light bulb flickering, where it is unconditioned joy. It's not based on the thinking and pondering. Anytime you see the word joy being used, this is unconditioned joy, that the mind isn't basing its joy in any particular thing. So if you were basing your happiness on the thinking and pondering, that means you can only be happy when you're thinking and pondering. And that thinking and pondering is not permanent. So that means your happiness isn't permanent. So whenever you see that the Buddha is describing joy, or he's using that word joy, it's based on unconditioned mental quality. And in the jhanas, that starts to peer through a bit. It's not permanent yet, but it is unconditioned joy that you start experiencing. The mind starts brightening up and it starts peering through because you're starting to get rid of the pollutions. And as you're doing that, it's starting to shine through a bit, but it's not yet permanent because the mind still has some craving. It still has some clinging. So it's not going to be in the mind permanently, but you'll start experiencing 1 minute, 1 hour, 1 day, 1 week, 1 month, where you'll start noticing this joy starting to peer through. Okay, I'm not seeing any other questions anywhere. So let me go to the next chapter, which is chapter 126. This one is titled, "That Spoken Elimination." "Venerable Sir, it is said, elimination, elimination. Through the elimination of what things is elimination spoken of? Form, Ananda, is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction, to vanishing, to fading away, to elimination. Through its elimination, elimination is spoken of. Feeling is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction, to vanishing, to fading away, to elimination. Through its elimination, elimination is spoken of. Perception is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction, to vanishing, to fading away, to elimination. Through its elimination, elimination is spoken of. Volitional formations, choices, decisions, are impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction, to vanishing, to fading away, to elimination. Through its elimination, elimination is spoken of. Consciousness is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction, to vanishing, to fading away, to elimination. Through its elimination, elimination is spoken of. It is through the elimination of these things, Ananda, that elimination is spoken of. Okay, so here the Buddha is referring to the five aggregates, the five collections, the five elements, and he's sharing that these things are all impermanent. And of course, you're not interested in believing him. If I were you, I would take each of these five aggregates and decide for yourself, is what the Buddha is actually saying true? Are they impermanent? Are they conditioned? Meaning, if they're conditioned, they arise, they change, and they fade away. And then he's saying they're dependently arisen, meaning there's some cause and condition that is producing these things to arise. And they're subject to destruction, meaning they're impermanent, to vanishing, meaning they're impermanent, to fading away, meaning they're impermanent, to elimination, meaning they're impermanent, right? So here you can reflect, is the physical form of the body impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction? Are the feelings the same? Are perceptions, are volitional formations, choices and decisions in the consciousness? And the reason why this is important for you is because this helps you to understand why it's unwise to cling to these things. That if you were not understanding that these are impermanent and you were craving for them to be permanent, now by craving and clinging and holding on to these things, wanting them to be permanent, now the mind will experience the discontentedness. But if you can come to realize through your own reflection that all of these things are impermanent, then the mind is less likely to cling to them. And this is what you're soaking into the mind so that you deeply understand that these things are all impermanent. So let me know what questions you guys have on this chapter. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions here. So I'm going to move on to the next one. And by the way, here you can see I described the five aggregates for you so you can understand what those are, which I taught in this class. This is chapter 127. It's titled, The Elimination of the Five Aggregates is the Elimination of Discontentedness. Monks, the elimination, subsiding, and passing away of form, of feeling, of perception, of volitional formations, choices and decisions, of consciousness, is the elimination of discontentedness, the subsiding of disease, the passing away of aging and death. Monks, when a monk is practicing in accordance with the teachings, this is what accords with the teachings. He should reside engrossed in fading away of strong feelings towards form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. One who resides engrossed in fading away of strong feelings towards form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness fully understands form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. One who fully understands form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness is freed from form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. He is freed from birth, aging, and death, freed from sorrow, grief, pain, displeasure, and despair, freed from discontentedness, I say. Okay, I'm going to pause here and help you understand what he's saying, and then we pick it up after that. So what he's saying here is that all of these aggregates, they are impermanent. They are subsiding, they're passing away. This is very similar to what he was saying previously, that all these five aggregates are impermanent. Form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. And by eliminating that clinging, this is the elimination of discontentedness, because you're no longer clinging to all of these five aggregates here. And he's calling this the subsiding of the disease, right? Sometimes people refer to the Buddha like a doctor, that there are certain ailments in the mind, there's these certain symptoms that are produced, and then there's the certain prescription that he's applying in order to help you eliminate that. So here he's referring to this discontentedness as a disease. So by eliminating the clinging to the five aggregates, this is the subsiding of the disease. The symptoms will go away. That discontentedness will go away. And then also, you'll experience the elimination of aging and death because you won't keep experiencing rebirth over and over and over and over again. So by eliminating clinging, you eliminate the discontentedness and you eliminate the cycle of rebirth. Then here he's saying, when a monk is practicing in accordance with the teachings, this is what accords with the teachings. He should reside engrossed in fading away of strong feelings towards the five aggregates. So what he's saying here is you should work to eliminate your clinging to these five aggregates. Those strong feelings that you experience as a result of clinging to these five aggregates, well, if you understand that your goal in practicing in accordance with the teachings is to eliminate discontentedness, and it's clinging to the five aggregates that is causing that, then your goal would be to eliminate those strong feelings by eliminating the craving and clinging. And that's what he's saying. Okay, if you understand this, that if you understand and you're engrossed in this fading away of strong feelings towards form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness, then you fully understand the five aggregates because you understand they're impermanent. So there's no reason to cling to them. So you understand what these five aggregates are and you understand they're impermanent. And that's the reason why you're engrossed in eliminating your clinging to them. One who fully understands the five aggregates is freed from the five aggregates, meaning you're free from the cycle of rebirth because these five aggregates is what is a living being. So if you can get free of this, then you can get free of the discontentedness and free of the cycle of rebirth. He is freed from birth, aging, death, and he's also free from the sorrow, grief, pain, displeasure, and despair, freed from discontentedness by eliminating the craving and clinging to these five aggregates. Now the Buddha is going to go through and explain the three universal truths as it relates to the five aggregates. Monks, when a monk is practicing in accordance with the teachings, this is what accords with the teachings. He should reside reflecting on impermanence in form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. One who resides reflecting on impermanence in form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness fully understands form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. One who fully understands form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness is freed from form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. He is freed from birth, aging, and death, freed from sorrow, grief, pain, displeasure, and despair, freed from discontentedness, I say. Monks, when a monk is practicing in accordance with the teachings, this is what accords with the teachings. He should reside reflecting on discontentedness in form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. One who resides reflecting on discontentedness in form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness fully understands form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. One who fully understands form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness is freed from form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. He is freed from birth, aging, and death, freed from sorrow, grief, pain, displeasure, and despair, freed from discontentedness, I say. Okay, so here I'll describe this. Previously, we've been talking about the impermanent nature of these five aggregates. Here, what he's saying is reflect on the fact that clinging to these five aggregates is going to produce discontentedness. This will help you to be able to see the truth. He's sharing with you, okay, I'm helping you learn here, and now reflect on this to see that these five aggregates, by clinging to them, is going to produce discontentedness. And that's how you can then become free of that through your practice. That if you understand and you can see clearly that these five aggregates are going to lead to discontentedness, then you can get free of it, because now you can start working to remove the craving and clinging with these five aggregates, because you see what's truly causing the mind to experience this discontentedness. Now the next one. Monks, when a monk is practicing in accordance with the teachings, this is what accords with the teachings. He should reside reflecting on non-self in form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. One who resides reflecting on non-self in form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness fully understands form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. One who fully understands form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness is freed from form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. He is freed from birth, aging, and death, freed from sorrow, grief, pain, displeasure, and despair, freed from discontentedness, I say. So here the Buddha is describing that none of these five aggregates is you. It's not who you are. When I'm teaching about personal existence view and the realization of non-self, the universal truth of non-self, I focus on the self-identity, which is connected to the physical form, and I focus on the self-identity, which is focused on the consciousness or what's inside the mind. But here you can see where the Buddha is describing that the feelings that you experience are not you. The perceptions, your views and opinions, your assumptions are not you. And the choices and decisions or the volitional formations are not you. And this is really important because rather than saying, I am angry or I am frustrated or I am irritated, you can understand that I am not frustrated. I am not angry. I am not irritated. The mind is experiencing anger. The mind is experiencing frustration. The mind is annoyed, right? So you can disassociate with this I if you can understand the universal truth of non-self. And now you can more easily cut off those discontent feelings and eliminate them and eradicate them from the mind. The same thing with your perceptions, your views and opinions. If you think like, I feel this way about politics, right? If there are certain politics that you have in your mind or certain other adamant opinions and views that this is how I feel about this particular thing. Now you might fight to death clinging to that perception. But if you can realize that this isn't you, this is just a view and opinion that is held in the mind, but it's not who you are as a person. And then you don't have to identify with this perception or this view, you can understand that that's not who you are. And then the same things about your choices and decisions. If you've made certain unwise choices in the past, sometimes people beat themselves up about that now in the present moment. And now if you identify with, I am an alcoholic, or I am a drug addict, or I was sexually abused, or I was mentally abused, or something like this. Now in the present moment, the mind clinging and associating with those choices and decisions that led to any particular experience, you can be experiencing painful feelings in the present moment. But you can train your mind to let this go. That while in the past you might have chosen to use drugs and alcohol, that doesn't define who you are as a person. While you might have experienced physical abuse or sexual abuse in the past, that doesn't define who you are as a person. So the Buddha is explaining that none of these things are you. It's not who you are. That's the real power in the universal truth of non-self, that by disassociating with any of these things as being you and who you are, you can get liberated from those strong feelings associated with the mind clinging to any of these aggregates, thinking that this is who you are as a person. So let me know what questions you guys have here on this particular teaching. This is the elimination of the five aggregates is the elimination of discontentedness. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions. Oh, here we go. This one is from Brent. Could a practitioner realize non-self but still have conceit? Yes. The conceit is the arrogance, the pride, the boastfulness, the judging, the measuring and comparing, looking down at others. So to realize non-self, you need to let go of these five aggregates and train the mind that this isn't who you are. But there could still be conceit and arrogance about other things that isn't related to any of these five aggregates. Maybe your child, if I don't think you have, or maybe you do have children, Brett, I'm not sure, I can't remember, but maybe somebody has pride about that. I do. Okay. Yeah. So maybe somebody has pride about their child. So it's not their five aggregates that they are holding on to in this particular case. They might have realized non-self, realizing that none of this is them, but they're still having pride about their children, or they're still measuring and comparing their children to other children and now looking down on other children or something like this. So the mind can still have conceit about these kinds of things. These are two separate things that we refer to as the ego, the personal existence view and the conceit, and that's what's coming together to form what we refer to as the ego. Let's see. Okay, we have a question here from Mayu Lee. When reflecting on the five aggregates and how it causes discontentedness in non-self, is this thinking and pondering? Yes, that's part of the thinking and pondering, that you're reflecting, you're being introspective, you're looking inward and trying to uncover the truth. The thinking and pondering that the Buddha is mainly talking about is certain decisions that you're making. You're reflecting on his teachings and trying to decide what would be wise or unwise. But you can think about thinking and pondering this way too, that you're looking inward and thinking about these teachings and being reflective and introspective. This is what's helping you to build the wisdom to then make wise decisions about how you do things in the world. All right. So I'll move on to the next chapter here, which is chapter 128. This one is titled, "The Elimination of the Six Sense Bases is the Elimination of Discontentedness." Monks, the elimination, subsiding, and passing away of the eye, of the ear, of the nose, of the tongue, of the body, of the mind, is the elimination of discontentedness, the subsiding of sickness, the passing away of aging and death. Monks, the elimination, subsiding, and passing away of forms, of sounds, of odors, of flavors, of physical objects, of mental objects, is the elimination of discontentedness, the subsiding of sickness, the passing away of aging and death. So here the Buddha is referring to the internal sense bases and the external sense bases. When we talk about the six sense bases, we're typically referring to the internal sense bases, but there's something called an internal sense base and an external sense base. The internal sense base are the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, the body, and the mind. These are the internal organs or sense bases that are longing and yearning. The mind's longing and yearning through these sense bases. But then there's these external sense bases. That is the form, the physical form that you see, or the sound, or the odor, the flavor, the physical object, or the mental object. These are the things that the internal sense bases are coming in contact with. So the eyes come in contact with a form. The ears come in contact with a sound. The nose comes in contact with an odor. The tongue comes in contact with a flavor. The body comes in contact with physical objects. And then the mind comes in contact with certain mental objects. So the Buddha is teaching you to eliminate the craving and clinging through these six sense bases, the internal sense bases, longing and yearning, to come in contact with the external sense bases. And this is just a short little excerpt here from a discourse where he's saying, okay, the elimination, subsiding, and passing away, meaning that the mind is no longer clinging to these things, is the elimination of discontentedness. It's the elimination of the cycle of rebirth. When he says the passing away of aging and death, he's saying it's the elimination of the cycle of rebirth, that when you eliminate sensual desire from your mind, this is moving the mind closer and closer to enlightenment. And then by getting to enlightenment, you're also eliminating the cycle of rebirth as well. So let me know what questions you guys have here. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So I'm going to move to the next one, which is chapter 129. Take a little drink of water. This one is titled, "Craving Abandon, No More Subject to Future Arising." Radha, whatever desire there is for form, whatever lust, excitement, craving, abandon it. Thus that form will be abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, obliterated, so that it is no more subject to future arising. Radha, whatever desire there is for feeling, perception, volitional formations, choices, decisions, and consciousness, whatever lust, excitement, craving, abandon it. Thus, that feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness will be abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, obliterated, so that it is no more subject to future arising. Radha, whatever desire there is for form, whatever lust, excitement, craving, whatever engagement in clinging, mental standpoints, adherences, and underlying tendencies, abandon them. Thus, that form will be abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, obliterated, so that it is no longer subject to future arising. Radha, whatever desire there is for feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness, whatever lust, excitement, craving, whatever engagement in clinging, mental standpoints, adherences, and underlying tendencies abandon them. Thus, that feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness will be abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, obliterated, so that it is no more subject to future arising. Okay, so here the Buddha is essentially talking about how to wring out the rag. This is the way that I describe it, that when you have craving, desire, attachment, clinging in your mind, if there's even just a slight little residue of any craving or clinging, you're going to experience discontentedness. It's not going to be extreme like you do when you have deeply held cravings, but if you just have the slightest little bit of craving or clinging in your mind, you're going to experience a slight little bit of discontentedness, a little bit of ickiness. By the time you get to enlightenment, you don't even have the slightest ickiness in the mind. And that's through wringing out the rag, or what the Buddha is describing here as that you cut it off at the root. You abandon it, make it like a palm stump. If you've ever been to places like here in Asia where there's a palm stump, you break it off like really close to the ground so that there's essentially nothing left, right? That's what you would like to get to, is you would like to obliterate any kind of craving for form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, or consciousness. No more longing and yearning. So I describe this as wringing out the rag and wringing it out and wringing it out and get every last little drop of craving and clinging out of the mind. If you see even the slightest little hint of it, you would like to obliterate it and destroy it. That's what's going to produce enlightenment for you. But if there's any little bit of residual, you're still going to experience a bit of discontentedness, and the mind's not going to make its way all the way to enlightenment. So this is why it's important to never convince the mind that you're enlightened, because you can go 1 month, 2 months, 3 months where you're quite peaceful and quite joyful, and you can kind of think that you're enlightened, but it'll sneak up on you. 3 months, 6 months, something will sneak up on you. Whoa, I didn't see that little craving there. Okay. Well, if you convince yourself that you're enlightened, you're going to miss that potentially. You're not going to pay close attention to it. You're not going to make it like a palm stump. You're not going to cut it off and uproot it so that it's no longer subject to future arising. So if you never convince yourself that you're enlightened, you can be 3 months of peacefulness. And then when you see that little bit of discontentedness, you'll know exactly what to do. Cut it off. Let it go. Look inward. What is the craving and clinging? Ah, here it is. Let me uproot that. Let me get rid of that. And now your mind will be liberated from that particular craving. And now maybe you go 6 months without any discontentedness. And then boom, here comes a little bit of discontentedness. If you convince yourself that you're enlightened, you might miss it because it's just this little bit of ickiness in the mind. So you need to be diligent and dedicated and determined. Be observant of the mind at all times with your mindfulness so that you can wring it out, so that by the time you eliminate all these fetters, that they're no longer subject to future arising, meaning that they won't arise in the future. I've seen some of these fetters go dormant for upwards of 6 months, and then they arose again. I thought they were gone, and here they come. Here comes another instance of that particular fetter arising. So you would like to get to the point where you obliterate it, and you don't even convince yourself that they're gone. That way you can stay diligent and dedicated to observing what's going on in the mind. So let me know what questions you guys have here. You can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, or you can raise your hand in Zoom and ask any questions that you like. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So I'm going to go to the last chapter for today. This is chapter 130. It's titled Elimination of Craving, called The Laying Down of the Burden. And what, monks, is the lying down of the burden? It is the remainderless fading away and elimination of that same craving, the giving up and letting go of it, freedom from it, non-reliance on it. This is called the lying down of the burden. This is what the perfectly enlightened one said. Having said this, the fortunate one, the teacher, further said this. The five aggregates are truly burdens. The burden carrier is the person. Taking up the burden is discontentedness in the world. Lying the burden down is joyful. Having laid the heavy burden down without taking up another burden, having taken out craving from its root, one is free from hunger, fully extinguished. Okay, so here what the Buddha is describing is a little bit in a poetic format. He's referring to these five aggregates that we've been talking about all throughout our class. And he's describing how taking them up is a burden. What he's saying is rebirth, being born into the world and taking up of these five aggregates, it's a burden to carry this around. If you look at your life in a particular day, you can look at how much time you're spending to take care of these five aggregates, from brushing your teeth, taking a shower, urinating, defecating, cleaning, eating, shopping, clothing, laundering clothes. You just keep looking at all the things, combing your hair, brushing your hair, all these different things that you do. You're constantly taking care of these five aggregates. And the Buddha is saying this is a burden to pick up these five aggregates. And then he's saying the burden carrier is the person. So that's where the body is one thing, the mind is another thing. And the combination of these two things we call a person, right? That's the burden carrier. That's the individual who's carrying this burden of the five aggregates. Taking up the burden is discontentedness in the world, meaning if you experience birth, you're going to experience discontentedness, but you can get liberated from that, of course. But coming into the world, the mind is coming into the world because it's unenlightened. It's taking up this burden of carrying these five aggregates, and now you're going to experience discontentedness in the world. But laying down the burden, meaning eliminating your craving and clinging, laying down these five aggregates and no longer clinging to them, this is joyful because you're no longer having to cling to these five aggregates. Of course, when you get enlightened, you're still going to brush your teeth, you're still going to take a shower, you're still going to eat and all these other things, but you'll do it joyfully with unconditioned joy, right? Where the mind's just always joyful because you've laid down the burden of the constant craving and clinging. Having laid down the heavy burden without taking up another burden, meaning without being reborn again, having taken craving out from its root, meaning that you fully extinguish the craving from the mind, one is free from hunger, meaning you no longer have craving, desire, attachment. You're no longer longing and yearning for existence and continuing to come back into this world over and over again. You're fully extinguished, meaning there's no longer any pollutions in mind, that the mind is liberated, it has freedom of strong feelings, and you do this through eliminating your craving and clinging. And here the Buddha is referring to it in terms of the five aggregates. But there's other craving and clinging besides the five aggregates as well. So let me know if you guys have any questions here on this one. You can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, or you can raise your hand in Zoom and ask any questions that you like. Okay, we have a question here from Brent, or maybe he's just a comment. Thank you, teacher. I had to switch to mobile, but greatly appreciate today's class. Yeah, no worry, Brent. No worries, Brent. Okay, let's see. I don't see any questions on any of the platforms. So I will just say thank you all for joining. Thank you for your questions. Thank you for your dedication and diligence to learning. Whether you're attending live or you're listening to this on the replay, thank you all for your dedication and diligence to learning and practicing. Next week, we're going to be in the next 10 chapters of this book, The Realms of Existence. This is volume 11 of the book series, The Words of the Buddha, The Path to Enlightenment, Revealing the Hidden. So we're going to be in chapters 131 to chapters 140, and we'll study those in the same way. So if you study those before class or after class, you'll get even more benefit out of the class itself, because you can read the words of the Buddha, you have the reference there to go back to the original source teachings, and you have reflections from me to be able to help you further glean information from the very clear and crisp teachings of the Buddha. And then tomorrow in our group learning program, we're going to be restarting from the very beginning. If you'd like to build a really nice foundation for the path to enlightenment, we're going to be starting from the very beginning of the group learning program. It's a 7-month program where each Sunday I'm going to be walking students through developing their life practice in the teachings of the Buddha, making their way to enlightenment. And then on Wednesdays, I'll be teaching meditation. So you can be joining that either live through Sunday at 9 a.m. or 9 p.m., or you can be listening to the replay on YouTube, Facebook, or on the podcast. And then on Wednesday, I'm going to be starting a 4-part series on breathing mindfulness meditation, where I'm going to be helping you to build up your breathing mindfulness meditation, and then also opening up to questions that anybody might have related to breathing mindfulness meditation or any of the other teachings as well. This is how I start the beginning of each group learning program, really going in deeply to the Eightfold Path and really going in deeply to breathing mindfulness meditation. So some people might be restarting that again for a second, third, fourth, fifth time, who knows? Many people have studied that group learning program many times, or other people might be starting from the very beginning. Everybody and anybody's welcome, whether you've ever learned the teachings of the Buddha or not, you're always welcome to learn. And all the classes, courses, and retreats are available at no cost, including the books and everything else. So thank you all for joining. Perhaps we'll see you in a future class. Have a very lovely and wonderful rest of your day. Sawadee krap.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To provide support for this podcast, visit patreon.com/supportbuddha. To access more teachings, visit buddhadailywisdom.com. There, you will discover a full range of courses, retreats, and online resources to assist you on the path to enlightenment. Remember, to establish a daily, consistent meditation practice, along with learning and practicing these teachings, a well-developed meditation practice is the foundation in which to train the mind to attain enlightenment.